early subway tunnels, of course, but right below was a layer of shitstone. "I beg your pardon?" Pendergast yelled. "Rotten Precambrian siltstone. We call it shitstone. You can run water and sewer lines through shitstone, but not a railroad tunnel. So they had to go deeper. Your devil's attic is 30 stories underground."
"But why?"
Diamond looked at the FBI agent in disbelief.
"Why? What do you think? Those fancy pantses didn't want to share any sightings or signals with regular train lines. With those deep tunnels, they could go straight out of the city, come up around Croton and be on their way. No delays, no mixing with the common folk."
"That doesn't explain why there's no record of their existence."
"Cost a fortune to build, and not all of it came from the pockets of the oil barons. They called in favors from City Hall."
Diamond tapped the side of his nose.
"That kind of construction you don't document."
"Why were they abandoned?"
"Impossible to maintain. Beneath most of the sewer and storm drains like they were, you could never keep them dry. Then there was methane buildup, carbon monoxide buildup, you name it."
Pendergast nodded.
"Heavy gases, seeking the lowest level."
"They spent millions on those damn tunnels. Never finished the line. They were only open for 2 years before the flood of 98 overwhelmed the pumps and half-filled everything with sewage. So they bricked everything up. Didn't even pull out the machinery or nothing."
Diamond fell silent, and the chamber filled once again with the roar of the vent stack.
"Are there any maps of these tunnels?"
Pendergast asked after a moment. Diamond rolled his eyes.
"Maps? I looked for maps for 20 years. Those maps don't exist. I learned what I learned by talking to a few old-timers."
"Have you been down there?"
Pendergast asked. Diamond twitched noticeably. Then after a long moment, he nodded silently.
"Could you diagram them for me?"
Diamond was silent. Pendergast moved closer.
"Any little thing you could do would be appreciated."
His hand seemed merely to smooth the lapel of his jacket, but suddenly a $100 bill flared between two of the slender fingers, arching in the engineer's direction. Diamond stared at the bill, as if deliberating. Finally, he took it, rolled it into a ball, and crammed it into a pocket. Then, turning to the drafting table, he began sketching deftly on a piece of yellow graph paper. An intricate system of tunnels began to take shape.
"Best I can do,"
he said, straightening up after a few minutes.
"That's the approach I use to get inside. A lot of the stuff south of the park has been filled with concrete, and the tunnels to the north collapsed years ago. You'll have to find your way down to the bottleneck first. Take feeder tunnel 18 down from where it intersects the old 24 water main."
"The bottleneck?"
Pendergast asked. Diamond nodded, scratching his nose with a dirty finger.
"There's a vein of granite running through the bedrock deep beneath the park. Super hard stuff. To save time and dynamite, the old pipe jockeys just blasted one massive hole in it and funneled everything through. The Astor tunnels are directly below. As far as I know, that's the only way to get inside them from the south. Unless you got a wetsuit, of course."
Pendergast accepted the paper, looking it over carefully.
"Thank you, Mr. Diamond. Is there any chance you'd be willing to return and make a more careful survey of the Devil's Attic? For adequate remuneration, of course."
Diamond took a long drink from the flask.
"All the money in the world wouldn't get me down there again."
Pendergast inclined his head.
"Another thing," Diamond said. "Don't call it the Devil's Attic, all right? That's mole talk. They're the Astor Tunnels."
"Astor Tunnels?"
"Yeah. They were Mrs. Astor's idea. The story goes that she got her husband to build the first private station beneath her Fifth Avenue mansion. That's how it all got started."
"Where did the name Devil's Attic come from?"
Pendergast asked. Diamond grinned mirthlessly.
"I don't know. But think about it. Imagine tunnels 30 stories underground, walls tiled in big murals. Imagine waiting rooms stuffed to the gills with mirrors, sofas, fancy stained glass. Imagine hydraulic elevators with parquet flooring and velvet curtains. Now, think of what all that would look like after being doused in raw sewage, then sealed up for a century."
He sat back and stared at Pendergast.
"I don't know about you, but to me, it would look like the attic of hell itself."
29. The West Side rail yard lay in a wide depression on the westernmost reaches of Manhattan, out of sight and practically invisible to the millions of New Yorkers who lived and worked nearby, its 74 acres the largest piece of undeveloped land on the island outside Central Park. Once a bustling hub of turn-of-the-century commerce, the rail yard now lay fallow, rusted tracks sunken among burdock and ailanthus trees, ancient sidings rotting and forgotten, abandoned warehouses sagging and covered with graffiti. For 20 years the piece of ground had been the subject of development plans, lawsuits, political manipulations, and bankruptcies. The tenants of the warehouses had gradually abandoned their leases and left, to be replaced by vandals, arsonists, and the homeless. In one corner of the rail yard lay a small, bedraggled shantytown of plywood, cardboard, and tin. Alongside were a few pathetic kitchen gardens of straggly peas and squash run riot. Margot stood amidst a plot of fire-scorched piles of rubble, sandwiched between two abandoned rail yard buildings. The warehouse occupying the plot had burned 4 months earlier, and it had burned hotly and thoroughly. The structure had been reduced to a blackened I-beam framework and some low cinder-block stem walls. Beneath her feet, the cement pad was hip-deep in rubble and burned shingles. The remains of several long metal tables stood in one corner of the lot, covered with smashed equipment and melted glass. She looked around, peering through the late afternoon shadows that knitted themselves across the sunken ground. There were several hulks that had once been large machines housed in metal cabinets. The cabinets had melted and the inner workings lay exposed, masses of twisted wire and ruined circuit boards. The acrid stench of burned plastic and tar clung stubbornly to everything. Augusta appeared at her side.
"What do you think?"
he asked. She shook her head.
"Are you sure this was Greg's last known address?"
"Confirmed it with the moving company. The warehouse burned about the time of his death, so it's doubtful he moved anywhere else. But he used an alias with Con Ed and New York Telephone, so he can't be certain."
"An alias?"
Margot continued to look around.
"I wonder if he died before or after this place burned."
"Not as much as I wonder," the ghoster replied.
"It looks like this was some kind of laboratory."
The ghoster nodded.
"Even I could have guessed that. This guy Kawakita was a scientist, just like you."
"Not quite. Greg was more involved with genetics and evolutionary biology. My specialty is anthropological pharmacology."
"Whatever."
The ghoster hiked up his pants.
"Question is, what kind of lab is it?"
"Hard to say. I'd need to learn more about those machines in the corner, and I'd have to map out the melted glass on these tables, try to recreate what the setups might have been."
The ghoster looked at her.
"Well?"
"Well what?"
"You want to take it on?"
Margot returned the lieutenant's gaze.
"Why me? You must have specialists in the department that—"
"They're not interested," the ghoster interrupted. "It ranks right below jaywalking on their list of priorities."
Margot frowned in surprise.
"The powers that be don't give a damn about Kawakita or what he was doing before he was killed. They think he was just a random victim, just like they think Brambell was a random victim."
"But you don't? You think he was involved in these murders somehow?"
The ghoster pulled a handkerchief out of his pocket and mopped his brow.
"Hell, I don't know. I just feel this guy Kawakita was up to something, and I'd like to know what it was."
"You knew him, right?"
"Yes," Margot said.
"I only met him once, when Frock had that goodbye party for Pendergast. What was he like?"
Margot thought a moment.
"He was brilliant. An excellent scientist."
"What about his personality?"
"He wasn't the nicest person in the museum," Margot said carefully. "He was, well, a little ruthless, I guess you could say. I felt he was the kind of person who would perhaps step over the line to advance his career. He didn't associate much with the rest of us, and didn't seem to trust anybody who might..." She stopped.
"Yeah?"
"Is this necessary? I hate to talk about someone who isn't around to defend himself."
"That's usually the best time. Was he the kind of guy to get involved in any criminal activity?"
"Absolutely not. I didn't always agree with his ethics. He was one of those scientists who held science above human values, but he was no criminal. She hesitated. He tried to reach me a while back, maybe a month or so before he died.
The ghost looked at her curiously. Any idea why? It doesn't seem like you two were exactly friends.
Not close friends, but we were colleagues. If he was in some kind of trouble...
A shadow crossed her face.
Maybe I could have done something about it, instead of just ignoring the call.
Guess you'll never know. But anyway, if you take the time to poke around, try to get some ideas of what he was doing here, I'd appreciate it.
Margot hesitated, and DeGosta gave her a closer look.
Who knows, he said in a quieter tone. Maybe it'll help lay some of those inner demons to rest.
Nice choice of words,
Margot thought. Still, she knew he meant well.
Lieutenant DeGosta, pop psychologist. Next thing you know, he'll be telling me that looking over this site will help give me closure.
She glanced over the ruined site for a long minute.
Okay, Lieutenant, she said at last.
Want me to get a photographer down here, take some pictures?
Maybe later. For now, I'd rather just make a few sketches.
Sure thing. The ghost seemed restless.
You go on, Margot said. You don't need to hang around.
No way, the ghost said. Not after Brambell.
Lieutenant,
I gotta collect some of the ashes anyway to test for trace accelerants. I'll stay out of your way.
He stood truculently, unmoving. Margot sighed, pulled a sketchbook out of her carry-all, and once again turned her attention to the ruined lab. It was a dreary place, surrounding her in silent accusation.
You could have done something. Greg tried to reach you. Perhaps it didn't have to end like this.
She shook her head, scattering the guilty thoughts. They wouldn't be of any help. Besides, if any place held the clues to explain what happened to Greg, this place would. And maybe the only way to get out of this nightmare was for her just to lower her head and go straight through. Anyway, it got her out of the forensic anthropology lab, which had started to look like a charnel house. The Bitterman corpse had arrived from NYME Wednesday afternoon, bringing a fresh set of questions along with it. The scoring on the neck bones of the still-fleshed corpse pointed to decapitation by some kind of rough, primitive knife. The killer, or killers, had been rushed in their grisly task. She quickly mapped out the rough outlines of the lab, sketching in the dimensions of the walls, the location of the tables, and the placement of the slag-like heaps of ruined equipment. Every laboratory had a flow to it, depending on what kind of work was being done. While the equipment might indicate the general kind of research, the flow itself would give clues to the specific application. The rough outlines completed, Margot moved to the tables themselves. Being metal, they had withstood the heat of the fire relatively well. She sketched out a rectangle to indicate each tabletop, then began noting the melted beakers, titration tubes, volumetric flasks, and other items still unidentifiable. It was a complex, multi-layered setup. Clearly, some kind of high-level biochemistry had been going on. But what? She paused for a moment, breathing in the mingled scents of burnt electrical insulation and the saline breeze off the Hudson. Then she turned her attention to the melted machinery. It was expensive stuff, judging from the brushed stainless steel cabinetry and the remains of flat panel and vacuum fluorescent displays. Margot tackled the largest machine first. Its metal casing had slumped in the heat, the innards detached. She gave it a light kick, shrinking back as it fell with a loud crash. She suddenly felt aware of how alone they were. Beyond the rail yards and across the river, the sun hung low over the New Jersey Palisades. She could hear the cry of seagulls as they wheeled over the rotting stumps of old piers rising from the Hudson's shore. Beyond the rail yards, a cheerful summer afternoon was ending. Yet here, in this sunken, abandoned place, no cheer came. She glanced at DeGosta, who had collected his samples and was standing in the late sun, arms crossed, staring out at the Hudson. Now she was glad he'd insisted on staying. She bent over the machine, smiling inwardly at her nervousness. Turning over the pieces of scorched and discolored metal, she eventually found the faceplate she was searching for. Rubbing it free of soot, she made out the words, Westerly Genetics Equipment, along with the WGE logo. Beneath, on the bezel was a stamped serial number and the words WGE Integrated DNA Analyzer Sequencer. She jotted the information down on her sketch pad. In a far corner was heaped a small pile of shattered, melted machinery that looked different from the rest. Margot examined it, carefully turning over each piece and laying it out, trying to figure out what it was. It seemed to be a rather complex organic chem synthesis setup, complete with fractionation and distillation apparatus, diffusion gradients, and low-voltage electrical nodes. Toward the bottom, where things were less damaged by the heat, she found the broken pieces of several Erlenmeyer flasks. Judging by the words on their frosted labels, most were normal lab chemicals. One fragmentary label, however, she did not immediately recognize. Activated 7-dehydrochol. She turned the piece over. Damn, the chemical name had a familiar ring to it. At last, she dropped the piece into her carry-all. No doubt it would be listed in the Organic Chem Encyclopedia back at the lab. Beside the machine were the remains of a thin notebook, burned through except for a few carbonized pages. As she picked it up curiously, it began to crumble in her hands. Carefully, she picked up the charred pieces, slid them carefully into a Ziploc bag, and stowed it in her carry-all. Within 15 minutes she had managed to identify enough of the other machines to be certain of one thing. This had once been a world-class genetics laboratory. Margot worked with similar machines on a daily basis, and she knew enough to estimate the cost of this ruined lab at over $500,000. She stepped back. Where did Kawakita get the money to fund this kind of lab? And what the hell could he have been up to? As she moved across the cement pad, making notations in her sketchbook, something odd caught her eye. Among the piles of rubble and melted glass, she made out what looked like 5 large puddles of mud, baked to a cement-like consistency by the fire. Around them were sprinkles of gravel. Curious, she bent over to examine the rubble more closely. There was a small metal object, about the size of her fist, embedded in the nearest puddle. Pulling a penknife from her carry-all, she pried out the object and scraped off the crust that clung to it like cement. Beneath the mud, she could make out mini-arium supl... Turning the object over and over in her hands, she realized what it was. An aquarium pump. She stood up, looking down at the 5 similar heaps of rubble lined up beneath the remaining skeleton of a wall. The gravel, the broken glass, these must have been aquaria. Huge, too, judging by the size of the puddles. But aquaria filled with mud? It didn't make sense. Kneeling, she took her penknife and worked it into the closest dried mass. It came away in pieces, like concrete. Picking up one of the larger pieces and turning it over, Margot was surprised to see what looked like the roots and partial stem of a plant, preserved from burning by the protective mud coating. Cursing the clumsiness of the penknife, she carefully worked the plant loose from the mud and held it up to the fading light. Suddenly, she dropped the plant and jerked her hand back, as if burned. After a moment, she picked it up again and examined it more closely, her heart suddenly racing. "It's not possible," she thought. She knew this plant, knew it well. The tough, fibrous stem, the bizarrely knotted roots, brought back searing memories. Sitting in the deserted genetics lab at the museum, face glued to the eyepiece of a microscope, mere hours before the disastrous opening of the Superstition exhibition. It was the rare Amazonian plant that the Umbuan creature had craved so desperately. The same plant Whittlesey had inadvertently used as packing material in the fateful crate of relics sent to the museum from the Upper Zhengu almost a decade before. The plant was now supposed to be extinct. Its original habitat had been wiped out, and all remaining vestiges of it at the museum had been destroyed by the authorities after the Umbuan creature, the museum beast, was finally killed. Margot stood up again, brushing soot from her knees. Greg Kawakita had somehow gotten his hands on this plant and had been growing it in these massive aquaria. But why? A sudden, horrible thought struck her. As quickly as it had come, she brushed it aside. Surely,
There was no second one creature that Greg had been feeding. Or was there?
Lieutenant? She asked. Do you know what this is?
He came over.
Not the clue, he replied.
Liliaceae umbonensis, the umbon plant.
She's shitting me, right?
Margot shook her head slowly.
I wish I were.
They stood, unmoving as the sun sank below the palisades, gilding the distant buildings across the river in a halo of oblique light. She looked again at the plant in her hand, preparing to place it in her carry-all, and noticed something that she had missed before. At the end of the root base, she could make out a small graft scar along the xylem, a long double V in the dim light. A graft scar like that, she knew, meant one of only two things, a common hybrid experiment, or a very sophisticated genetic engineering experiment. 30. Hayward pushed the door open brusquely, her cheeks still full of lunch.
Captain Waxy just called, she said, swallowing the tuna fish. Wants you down in the IU right away. They got him.
DeGosta looked up from placing the final pins in a missing persons map that replaced the one taken by Waxy.
Got who?
Him. The copycat killer, of course.
She gave DeGosta an ironic grin.
No shit.
DeGosta was at the door in a second, pulling his suit jacket off the hanger and shrugging into it.
Caught him in the ramble, Hayward said as they walked through the office pool toward the elevator bank.
Somebody on stakeout heard a commotion, went to check it out. The guy had just knifed a vagrant and was preparing to cut off his head.
How'd they know that?
Hayward shrugged.
Ask Captain Waxy.
And the knife?
Homemade job. Real rough. Just what they were looking for.
She didn't sound convinced. The elevator doors opened to reveal Pendergast. Seeing DeGosta and Hayward about to step in, he raised his eyebrows quizzically.
The killer's in the IU, DeGosta said. Waxy wants me down there.
Indeed.
The FBI agent stepped back and pressed the button for the second floor.
Well, let's head down there by all means. I'm curious to see exactly what kind of fish Angler Waxy has landed.
The interrogation unit of One Police Plaza was a grim series of gray-colored rooms with cinder-block walls and heavy metal doors. The cop on desk duty buzzed them through, directing them to the observation area of Room 9. Inside, Waxy was lounging in a chair, looking through the one-way glass into the interrogation cell. He glanced up when he heard them enter, frowned when he saw Pendergast, grunted at DeGosta, and ignored Hayward.
Is he talking?
DeGosta said. Waxy grunted again.
Oh, yeah. Talking is all he's doing. But so far, we've only heard a load of shit. Calls himself Jeffrey, won't give anything else. We'll get the real story out of him soon, though. Meanwhile, thought you might like to ask him a few questions.
In his triumph, Waxy was generous, brimming with smug self-confidence. Looking through the glass, DeGosta could see an unkempt, wild-eyed man. The rapid, silent movements of the suspect's mouth were an almost humorous contrast with his stiff, unmoving body.
"This is the guy?" DeGosta said in disbelief.
"That's him."
DeGosta kept looking through the glass.
"Looks kind of small to have done so much damage."
Waxy's mouth set in a defensive frown.
"Maybe he got sand kicked in his face one too many times."
DeGosta leaned forward and pressed the mic button. Instantly, a torrent of curses spewed from the speaker above the one-way window. DeGosta listened for a moment, then snapped the mic button off.
"What about the murder weapon?" he asked.
Waxy shrugged.
"It's a handmade thing. A piece of steel sunk into a wooden shank. The handle's been wrapped in cloth, gauze, something like that. Too bloody to tell. We'll have to wait until forensics gets done with it."
"Steel?"
Pendergast said.
"Steel,"
Waxy replied.
"Not stone."
"I said it was steel. Take a look for yourself."
"We will,"
DeGosta said, stepping away from the window.
"But for now, let's see what this guy has to say."
He headed for the door, Pendergast gliding behind him like a silent spirit.
Number 9 looked like countless interrogation rooms in countless police stations across the country. A scarred wooden table sat in the middle of the stark space. On the far side of the table, the prisoner sat in a straight-backed chair, arms cuffed behind his back. A single detective sat in one of several chairs on the table's near side, enduring the verbal abuse with complete disinterest as he manned the tape recorder. Police officers, armed and in uniform, faced each other from across the room. Two huge, black-and-white blow-ups hung on the side walls. One showed the torn and broken body of Nicholas Bitterman, lying on the men's room floor inside Belvedere Castle. The other was the now famous Post photo of Pamela Wisher. A video camera was fixed in one corner of the ceiling, dispassionately recording the proceedings. DeGosta took a seat at the table, inhaling the familiar blend of sweat, damp socks, and fear. Waxy followed him in, settling his bulk carefully into an adjoining chair. Hayward stood next to the closest uniformed officer. Pendergast closed the door, then leaned against it, the crisp black arms of his suit folded casually, one over the other. The prisoner had stopped shouting when the door opened. Now he glared at the new arrivals through a greasy lock of hair. His eyes lighted on Hayward, lingered for a moment, then moved on.
"What the hell are you looking at?"
he said at last to DeGosta. "Don't know," DeGosta replied. "You want to tell me about it?"
"Piss off!"
DeGosta sighed. "You understand your rights?" The prisoner grinned, exposing small, filthy teeth.
"That fat mother next to you read 'em to me. I don't need no lawyer to hold my hand." "You watch your mouth!"
Waxy snapped, flushing an angry crimson.
"No, fat boy, you watch yours and your fat ass!"
He cackled with laughter. Hayward didn't bother to suppress a smirk. DeGosta wondered if this was how they had been carrying on before he got there.
"So, what happened in the park?" he asked.
"You want a list? For firstly, he was in my sleeping spot. For secondly, he hissed at me like a snake out of Egypt. For thirdly, he lacked the blessings of God. For fourthly, he..."
Waxy waved his hand. "We get the picture. Tell us about the others." Jeffrey said nothing.
"Come on," Waxy pushed. "Who else?"
"Plenty,"
came the reply at last.
"Nobody disses me and gets away with it."
He leaned forward.
"Better watch out, fat boy, case I carve a piece of blubber off you."
DeGosta placed a restraining hand on Waxy.
"So who else you done?" he asked quickly.
"Oh, they know me.
They know Jeffrey, the cherub cat. I'm on my way."
"What about Pamela Wisher?" Waxy broke in.
"Don't deny it, Jeffrey."
The seams at the corners of the prisoner's muddy eyes thickened.
"I don't deny it. The scumbags disrespected me, all of them. They deserved it."
"And what did you do with the heads?" Waxy asked breathlessly.
"Heads?" Jeffrey asked. To DeGosta, he seemed to falter slightly.
"You're in too deep now. Don't start denying." "Heads. I ate their heads, is what I did."
Waxy cast a triumphant gaze towards DeGosta.
"What about the guy at Belvedere Castle, Nick Bitterman? Tell me about him."
"Oh, that was a good one. That mother had no respect. Hypocrite. Miser. He was the adversary."
He rocked back and forth.
"Adversary?"
DeGosta asked, frowning.
"The prince of adversaries."
"Yes," said Pendergast sympathetically. "You must counteract the powers of darkness." They were the first words he'd spoken since entering. The prisoner rocked more vigorously.
"Yes. Yes. With your electrical skin."
Suddenly the rocking stopped.
"And your glaring eyes,"
Pendergast continued. Then he pushed himself away from the door and came forward slowly, looking directly at the suspect. Jeffrey stared hard at Pendergast.
"Who are you?"
he breathed. Pendergast was silent for a moment.
"Kit Smart,"
he said at last, without removing his eyes from Jeffrey. To DeGosta, the change that came over the prisoner was shocking. The color seemed to drain from his face in an instant. He looked at Pendergast, mouth working silently. Then, with a shriek, he forced himself backwards with such force that the chair tipped over and crashed to the floor. Hayward and the two police guards sprang to subdue the struggling figure.
"Jesus, Pendergast, what the hell did you say to him?"
Waxy said over the screams, hoisting himself to his feet.
The right thing, apparently. Pendergast glanced at Hayward. Please give this fellow every comfort. I think we can let Captain Waxy take over from here.
So who is that guy?
The ghost asked as the elevator carried them back up toward the homicide division.
I'm not sure what his real name is, Pendergast replied, smoothing his tie. But it isn't Jeffrey, and he's not the person we're looking for.
They'll Waxy that.
Pendergast glanced mildly at the ghoster.
What we saw, Lieutenant, was a classic case of paranoid schizophrenia, aggravated by multiple personality disorder. You noticed how the man seemed to weave in and out of two personas? There was the blustering tough guy, no doubt as unconvincing to you as to me. Then there was the killer visionary, infinitely more dangerous. Did you hear? For secondly, he hissed at me like a snake out of Egypt, or Jeffrey the Cherub Cat. Of course I heard it. The guy was talking like somebody just handed him the Ten Commandments or something.
Or something. You're right. His ravings had the structure and cadence of written speech. This occurred to me also. At that point I recognized he was quoting from the old poem Jubilate Anno by Christopher Smart.
Never heard of it.
Pendergast smiled faintly.
It's a fairly obscure work by a fairly obscure writer. It is undeniably powerful in its strange vision, however. You should read it. The author, Smart, wrote it while he himself was half insane in a debtor's prison. In any case, there's a long passage in the poem in which Smart describes his cat, Jeffrey, whom Smart believed to be some kind of chrysalis creature undergoing a physical conversion.
Yeah, if you say so. But what does all this have to do with our vocal friend back there?
Obviously, the poor fellow identifies himself with the cat in the poem.
The cat?
The ghost asked incredulously.
Why not? Kit Smart, the real Kit Smart, certainly did. It's an extremely powerful image of metamorphosis. I feel sure this poor fellow was once an academician or a failed poet before the creeping descent into madness began. He killed one man, true enough, but only when his path was crossed at the wrong time. As for the rest...
Pendergast waved his hand.
There are many indications this man is not our true target.
Like the photographs, the ghoster said.
All good interrogators knew that no killer could keep his eyes from photographs of his victims or artifacts from the crime scene. Yet, as far as the ghoster could tell, Jeffrey had never moved his eyes to either picture.
Exactly.
The elevator doors whispered open, and the two made their way through the hubbub toward the ghoster's office.
Or the fact that this murder, as Waxy describes it, has none of the elements of the blitzkrieg attack suffered by the other victims. In any case, once I recognized his neurotic identification with the poem, it was easy enough to goad his madness to the surface.
Pendergast closed the office door and waited until the ghoster was seated, before continuing.
But let's put this irritating business behind us. Have you had any luck on that cross-correlation I requested?
DP just delivered it this morning.
The ghoster thumbed through a tall sheaf of mini-printer output.
Let's see. 85% of the victims were male and 92% were residents of Manhattan, including transients.
I'm primarily interested in things that all the victims had in common.
Gotcha.
There was a pause.
All had last names beginning with letters other than I, S, U, V, X, and Z.
Pendergast's mouth twitched in what might have been a faint smile.
All were older than 12 and younger than 56. None of the victims were born in November.
Go on.
I think that's it.
The ghoster flipped some more pages.
Ah, here's something else. We ran the data through SMUD, checking for various traits associated with serial murderers. The only common thread it found was that none of the murders were committed during a full moon.
Pendergast sat up. Indeed. That's worth remembering. Anything else?
No, that's it.
Thank you.
He sank back in the chair.
Still, it's precious little. Information is what we need, Vincent. Hard facts. And that's why I can't wait any longer.
The ghost looked at him, uncomprehending. Then he frowned.
You're not going down again.
Indeed I am. If Captain Waxy continues to insist this man is the killer, then the extra patrols will be called off. Vigilance will fade, creating an atmosphere that can only make additional killings easier.
Where will you go?
The ghost asked. To the devil's attic? The ghost snorted.
Come on, Pentagast. You don't even know if such a place exists, let alone how to get there. You got nothing but the word of that hobo.
In this case, I believe Mephisto's word to be reliable, Pendergast replied. And in any case, I have considerably more than just his word. I've spoken with a city engineer named Al Diamond. He explained that the so-called Devil's Attic is in reality a series of tunnels constructed by New York's wealthiest families before the turn of the century. They were intended as a private rail line, but abandoned after only a few years, and I've been able to reconstruct a rough approximation of the route of these tunnels. Taking a marker from the desk, Pendergast moved the missing person's map. He set the point of the marker down at the intersection of Park and 45th, drew a line over to 5th, up to Grand Army Plaza, then diagonally across Central Park and north up Central Park West. Then he stepped back, looking at the Ghosta bemusedly. The Ghosta stared at the map. Except for a few locations in the park, almost all the white and red pins were clustered along the lines Pendergast had drawn.
Holy shit, he breathed.
You could say that, Pendergast said. Diamond also pointed out that the sections of tunnels to the south and north of the park have been sealed off, so it's beneath the park that I go. The Ghoster reached into his desk for a cigar.
I'm coming along.
Sorry, Vincent. You're essential up here, now that the rest of the force is about to let down its guard, and I need you to work with Margot Green to determine the precise nature of Kawakita's movements. We haven't yet heard the last of his involvement in all this. In any case, this time around my goal will be stealth. It's an extremely dangerous trip. Two of us would double the chances of our being discovered. He replaced the marker cap with a snap of his finger. However, if you could spare Sergeant Hayward's expertise for a few hours, I could use some help in my preparations.
Scowling, the ghost put the cigar down.
Christ, Pendergast! That's a long trip down. You'll be gone overnight.
More than that, I'm afraid. The FBI agent put the marker back on the desk. If you don't hear from me within 72 hours... He paused. Then, suddenly, he smiled and grasped the Ghost's hand. A rescue mission would be foolish.
What about food?
Pendergast feigned surprise.
Have you forgotten the delicacy of track rabbit au vin, spit-roasted over an open fire?
The Ghoster grimaced, and Pendergast smiled reassuringly.
Fear not, Lieutenant, I'll be well provisioned. Food, maps, all I need.
It's like the journey to the center of the earth, the Ghoster said, shaking his head.
Indeed. I do feel a bit like an explorer setting out into parts unknown, peopled by unknown tribes. Odd to think it exists directly beneath our feet.
Cui ci sono dei mostri, my friend. Let us hope I avoid i mostri. Friend Hayward will see me off. Pendergast stood motionless a moment, apparently lost in thought. Then, with a final nod at the Ghosta, he swept out of the office and into the corridor beyond, the silk nap of his black suit shining dully under the fluorescent lights, the last of the great explorers. 31. Pendergast walked swiftly up the broad steps toward the entrance of the New York Public Library, a large leather and canvas valise in one hand. Behind him, Hayward stopped to stare at the huge marble lions that flanked the stairway.
"You needn't look so worried, Sergeant," Pendergast said. "They've already had their afternoon feeding."
Despite the warmth of the day, he was wearing a tightly buttoned olive duster that reached almost to his ankles. Inside, the marble entrance hall was dim and pleasantly cool. Pendergast spoke quietly to a guard, showed his ID, asked a few questions. Then he nodded for Hayward to follow him through a doorway underneath the sweeping double staircase.
"Sergeant Hayward, you know underground Manhattan better than any of us," Pendergast said as they stepped into a small, leather-lined elevator. "You've already given me invaluable advice. Any last words?"
The elevator began lurching downward.
"Yes,"
Hayward replied. "Don't go." Pendergast smiled thinly.
"I'm afraid that isn't an option. Only first-hand reconnaissance will prove whether or not the Astor tunnels are really the source of these killings."
"Then take me with you," Hayward said immediately. Pendergast shook his head.
"Believe me, I wish I could. But my aim this time is stealth. Two bodies would make an unacceptable noise signature."
The elevator stopped at the lowest level, 3B, and they stepped out into a dark corridor.
"Then watch your butt," Hayward said.
"Most of the moles go down there to escape from confrontation, not start it. But there are plenty of predators. Drugs and alcohol only make things worse. Remember that they can see better, they can hear better, and they know the tunnels. Any way you look at it, you're at a disadvantage."
"True," Pendergast said. "So I'll do what I can to even the odds."
He stopped in front of an ancient door, opened it with a key, and ushered Hayward inside. The room beyond was stacked, floor to ceiling, with metal racks filled with ancient books. The passageways between the racks were barely 20 inches across. The smell of dust and mildew was almost overpowering.
"What are we doing here anyway?"
Hayward asked as she followed Pendergast through the stacks.
"Of all the structures I examined," Pendergast said, "this building had the best plans and the clearest access to the Astor tunnels. I still have a long descent ahead, and I'm going down somewhat south of my final destination, but it seemed prudent to minimize the risks."
He stopped a moment, looking around.
"Ah," he said, nodding down one of the narrow rows. "This must be it."
He unlocked another, much smaller door in the far wall and led Hayward down a staircase to a cramped little room with an unfinished floor. "Directly beneath us is an access tube," he said. "It was begun in 1925 as part of a pneumatic system to deliver books to the Mid-Manhattan Library. The project was abandoned during the Depression and never resumed. However, it should allow me to access a main feeder tunnel." Pendergast set down the valise, inspected the floor with a flashlight, then finally brushed the dust away from an ancient trap door. He lifted it with Hayward's help, exposing a slender black tube lined with tiles. Poking the flashlight down into the darkness, he looked around for a few moments. Then, apparently satisfied, he straightened up, unbuttoning the long duster as he did so. Hayward's eyes narrowed in surprise. Beneath the duster, the FBI agent was wearing a set of military fatigues in broken gray and black pattern. The zippers and buckles were plastic with a matte black finish. Pendergast smiled.
"Unusual camos, aren't they?" he said. "Note the gray tones instead of the usual sepia. Designed for use in blackout conditions."
He opened an attaché case, then knelt in front of the valise, unfastening and opening it wide. From one compartment he removed a tube of military-issue blackout, which he began applying to his face and hands. Next he removed a rolled piece of felt. As Pendergast checked it, Hayward noticed several pockets had been sewed into its inside edge. "A pocket disguise kit," Pendergast said. "Safety razor, towelettes, mirror, spirit gum. My intent this time is to avoid detection. I don't wish to meet anybody or anything, but I'll bring this along just in case." He stuffed the tube of grease paint into one of the pockets, then rolled up the kit and placed it inside his shirt. Reaching into the valise, he removed a short-barreled pistol whose dull finish reminded Hayward more of plastic than metal.
"What's that?" she asked curiously.
Pendergast turned it over in his hands.
"It's an experimental 9mm, created by Anschluss GmbH. It fires a T-round composite bullet of ceramic and Teflon."
"Planning on going hunting?"
"You may have heard about my encounter with the Umbuan beast," Pendergast replied. "That experience taught me that one should always be prepared. This little handgun could send a bullet through an elephant, lengthwise."
"An offensive weapon," Hayward replied, "in more ways than one."
"I'll take that as a sign of approval," Pendergast said. "Of course,
defense will be at least as important as offense. I have my own armor. He pulled back the fatigues to expose a bulletproof vest. Reaching into the valise again, he removed a black skullcap made of Kevlar, which he snugged onto his head. As Hayward watched, Pendergast removed a water-purifying kit and several other articles, placing them in various pockets. Finally, he pulled out two carefully sealed plastic bags. Inside were strips of something that looked like black shoe leather. "Pemmican," he said. "What?" "Filet mignon, cut into strips and dried, then pounded with berries, fruits, and nuts. It has all the vitamins, minerals, and protein a man needs, and it is surprisingly edible. Nobody has yet invented a better expedition food than Native Americans. Lewis and Clark lived on it for months." "Well, I guess you're provisioned anyway," Hayward said, shaking her head, "provided you don't get lost." Pendergast unzipped the top of his fatigues, displaying the inner lining. "Perhaps my most vital possession, maps. Like the flyers of the World War II, I've traced them on my flight jacket, so to speak." He nodded at the complicated set of lines, tunnels, and levels that had been drawn on the cream-colored lining in a precise hand. He zipped up the camos and then, as if remembering something, dug in his pockets and handed a set of keys to Hayward. "I meant to tape these to prevent any jingling. You'd better hold them for me." From another pocket, he removed his wallet and FBI identification, which he also passed to the sergeant. "Please give this to Lieutenant DaGosta. I won't be needing these below." He ran his hands quickly over his clothes, as if to reassure himself that everything was in place. Then he turned once again toward the trap door and lowered himself gingerly into the tube. "I appreciate your taking care of this for me," he said, nodding at the valise. "No problem," Hayward replied. "Send me a postcard." The trapdoor shut over the dank black tube, and Hayward sealed it with a quick twirl of her wrist. 32. Margot stared at the titration, scarcely blinking. As each clear drop trembled and fell into the solution, she waited expectantly for a color change. The sound of Frock's low breathing behind her, as he, too, stared at the apparatus, reminded her that she was unconsciously holding her breath. Suddenly the solution blossomed a bright yellow color. Margot turned the glass stopcock, stopping the flow of solution, and recorded the level on the graduated cylinder. She took a step back, aware that an unpleasantly familiar feeling was settling over her, a sense of unease, even dread. Standing motionless, she remembered the drama that had played out in another laboratory, a mere 100 feet down the hall and 18 months into the past. It had been just the two of them that time as well, crowded around Greg Kawakita's genetic extrapolator, watching as the program listed the physical attributes of the creature that would come to be known as Mbwun, the museum beast. She remembered almost cursing John Whittlesey, the scientist whose expedition had been lost in the depths of the Amazon. Whittlesey, who had inadvertently used a certain aquatic plant as packing fibers for the specimens he'd sent back to the museum. Unknown to Whittlesey, unknown to all of them, the Mbwun beast had been addicted to the plant. It needed the hormones in the plant in order to survive, and when its own habitat was destroyed, the beast went in search of the only remaining source of the plant, the packing fibers in the crates. But by a supreme irony, the crates were later locked in the museum's secure area, forcing the creature to go after the closest substitute to the plant hormones it could find, the hypothalamus of the human brain. As Margot stared at the yellow solution, she realized that she was feeling something else besides dread. Dissatisfaction. There was something strange here, something unexplained. She had felt the same way after the carcass of the Mbwun beast had been taken away following the slaughter of the Superstition Exhibition's opening night. Taken away in a van with government plates and never seen again. Though she'd never wanted to admit it, she'd always sensed, somehow, that they'd never gotten to the bottom of the story, never really understood what Mbwun was. At the time, she'd hoped to see autopsy results, a pathology report, something that could explain how the beast had known to come to the museum in the first place, or why the creature showed such a high proportion of human genes, something, anything that could bring the story to a close, even, perhaps, lay her own nightmares to rest. She realized now that Frock's own theory of Mbwun being an evolutionary aberration had never completely convinced her. Against her will, she forced herself to think back to those few moments she'd actually seen the beast,
charging down the darkened hallway toward herself and Pendergast, triumph in its feral eyes. To her, it looked more like a hybrid than an aberration. But a hybrid of what? The sound of Frock shifting in his wheelchair chased her thoughts away. "Let's try it once again," he said, "to be sure."
"I'm already sure," Margot replied.
"My dear," Frock said with a smile, "you are too young to be sure of anything. Remember, all experimental results must be reproducible. I don't mean to disappoint you, but I fear that this will all turn out to be a waste of time better spent examining the Bitterman corpse."
Margot began setting up the titration again, swallowing her irritation. At the rate they were going, they wouldn't have results on her finds at Kawakita's ruined lab for weeks. Frock was famous for the care and precision of his scientific experiments, and he seemed, as usual, supremely unaware that time was of the essence. But then, like most great scientists, he was self-absorbed, much more interested in his own work and his own theories than anyone else's. She remembered the conferences they'd had while he was her dissertation advisor, in which he would tell one story after another about his adventures in Africa, South America, or Australia, in the days before he became crippled, devoting more time to his own tales than to discussing her research. They had been working for hours on titrations and linear regression programs, trying to coax some kind of results out of the plant fibers she'd found at the site. Margot watched the solution, massaging the small of her back. DeGosta had been certain there was some kind of psychoactive drug in the fibers, but so far they had found nothing to support that theory.
"If only they'd kept some of the original plant fibers," Margot thought, "we could do cross-comparison studies."
But the CDC had demanded that all traces of the original fibers be destroyed. They'd even insisted on incinerating her handbag, which she'd once used to transport some of the fibers.
That was another thing. If all the remaining fibers had been destroyed, how had Greg Kawakita obtained some of his own? How had he managed to grow them? And above all else, why?
And then there was the mystery of the flask marked Activated 7-D Hydrocol. The missing piece was obviously sterol. She'd looked it up and had to laugh at her own stupidity. Of course she knew why it sounded so familiar. It was the most common form of vitamin D3. Once she had that figured out, it didn't take long to see that the organic chem equipment in Kawakita's lab had been a little setup hastily improvised for synthesizing vitamin D. But why? The solution turned yellow, and she marked the level, exactly the same as she knew it would be. Frock, putting away some equipment on the far side of the lab, took no notice. She hesitated a moment, deciding what to do next. Then she moved to the stereo zoom, where she carefully teased yet another small fiber from their rapidly dwindling sample. Frock rumbled over as she manipulated the microscope stage.
"It's 7 o'clock, Margot," he said gently. "Forgive me, but I think you've been working too hard. May I suggest we break for the evening?"
Margot smiled. "I'm almost done, Dr. Frock. I'd like to do one last thing, then I'll call it a day."
"Ah, and what might that be?"
"I thought I'd just freeze-fracture a specimen and get a 10-angstrom SEM image." Frock frowned.
"Toward what end?"
Margot stared at the specimen, a tiny dot on the glass stage.
"I'm not really sure. When we first studied this plant, we knew it carried a real virus of some kind, a virus that coded for both human and animal proteins. I wanted to see if this virus might be the source of the drug."
A low rumble shook Frock's capacious front, finally erupting as a chuckle.
"Margot, I would say it is definitely time for a break," he said. "This is wild speculation."
"Perhaps," Margot said, "but I'd prefer to call it a hunch."
Frock looked at her a moment, then sighed deeply.
"As you wish," he said, "but I, for one, need my rest. I'll be at Morristown Memorial tomorrow, enduring that annual battery of tests they seem to force on you in retirement. See you Wednesday morning, my dear."
Margot said goodbye, watching as Frock wheeled himself out into the corridor. She was beginning to realize that the famous scientist did not enjoy being crossed. When she'd been his graduate student, timid and compliant, he'd always been utterly charming, the soul of gentility. But now that Frock was emeritus and she was a curator in her own right, expressing her own ideas, he sometimes seemed less than pleased with the new assertiveness. She brushed the tiny sample into a specimen well and carried it to the freeze-fracture machine. Inside the machine, it would be encased in a small plastic block, frozen to nearly absolute zero and cleaved in two. Then the scanning electron microscope would make an extremely high-resolution picture of the fractured surface. Frock was right, of course. Under normal circumstances, a procedure such as this would have no bearing on their research. She'd called it a hunch, but in reality, it was for lack of anything else to try. Soon, a green light appeared on the cryogenic machine. Handling the block with an electronic cradle, Margot moved it onto the cleaving stage. The diamond cleaver descended with a smooth motion. There was a faint click, and the block separated. Placing one of the halves in the SEM, she carefully adjusted the mount, scanning controls and electron beam. In a few minutes, a crisp black-and-white image appeared on the adjoining screen. Staring at it, Margot felt her blood run cold. As expected, she could make out small hexagonal particles, the real virus that Kawakita's extrapolation program had originally detected in the plant fibers 18 months earlier. But here, it existed in an unbelievably high concentration. The plant organelles were literally packed with it, and surrounding the particles were large vacuoles that held some kind of crystallized secretion that could only come from the real virus itself. She breathed out slowly. The high concentrations, the crystallized secretions, could mean only one thing. This plant, Lelicii mbuonensis, was only a carrier. The virus made the drug. And the reason they couldn't find traces of the drug was because the drug was encapsulated inside the vacuoles. Well then, she thought, the answer was simple. Isolate the real virus, grow it in a medium, and see what drug it produces.
Kawakita must have thought of this.
Perhaps Kawakita hadn't been trying to genetically engineer the plant at all. Perhaps he was genetically engineering the virus. If that were the case... Margot sat down, her mind working furiously. At last, things seemed to be dovetailing. The old research and the new, the viral matter and its host plant, Mbuon, the fibers. But it still didn't explain why Kawakita had left the museum to do this. And it didn't explain how the Mbuon creature could have come all that distance from the Amazon rainforest in search of the plants that the Whittlesey expedition had...
Whittlesey.
In an instant she was on her feet, hand pressed to her mouth, the lab chair clattering to the linoleum floor. Suddenly, everything had become perfectly, terrifyingly clear. 33. This time, when Smithback was shown into the 18th floor foyer of 9 Central Park South, he noticed immediately that the windows of the vast drawing room beyond had been thrown wide. Sunlight streamed in, gilding the sofas and rosewood tables, turning what once had seemed like a funeral parlor into a blaze of warmth and brilliance. Annette Wisher was sitting at a glass-topped table on the balcony, wearing a fashionable straw sun hat and dark glasses. She turned to him, smiled slightly, and motioned him to take a seat. Smithback did so, glancing admiringly at the vast green carpet of Central Park, unrolling itself northward to 110th Street.
"Bring Mr. Smithback some tea," Mrs. Wisher said to the maid who had shown him in.
"Call me Bill, please," Smithback said, shaking the proffered hand.
He couldn't help noticing that, even in the bright, unforgiving light of the summer sun, Mrs. Wisher's skin looked remarkably free from the ravages of time. It had a youthful resiliency, creamy and smooth without the flabby softness of age.
"I appreciate the patience you've shown," she said, withdrawing her hand.
"I think you'll agree it's about to be rewarded. We've decided on a course of action, and as promised, I wanted you to be the first to know. Of course, it's to be kept a secret." Smithback accepted the tea, drinking in the faint, expensive aroma of jasmine. He felt a warm glow sitting in this lovely apartment with all of Manhattan spread out below him, drinking tea with the one woman every journalist in the city wanted to interview. It even made up for being scooped so humiliatingly by that smug bastard Bryce Harriman.
"The Grand Army Plaza rally was so successful, we decided to push Take Back Our City into a new phase," Mrs. Wisher said.
Smithback nodded.
"Our plan is quite simple, really. All future actions will be unannounced. Each will take place on a grander scale, and for every new murder that is committed, our people will descend on police headquarters, demanding an end to the outrage."
She raised one hand, smoothing a stray wisp of hair.
"But I don't expect we shall have to wait long to see some real changes."
"And why is that?" Smithback asked eagerly.
"At 6 o'clock tomorrow evening, our people will gather outside St. Patrick's Cathedral. Believe me, the group you saw at Grand Army Plaza will seem minuscule by comparison. We mean to show this city we are deadly serious. We will move up Fifth Avenue, across Central Park South, and then north on Central Park West, stopping for a candlelight vigil at the site of every murder. Then we shall converge on the great lawn in Central Park